You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome to One Bite is Everything, the podcast that connects every bite you take to the bigger world, sparking curiosity and inspiring you to ask more questions about the food on your plate. I am your host, Dana DeBrima. Today, we're heading to Texas to meet Stacy Roussel of All We Need Farm, a farmer who turned 4 acres of grass into a thriving goat dairy, a popsicle business with over 40 flavors and a model for what resilience and creativity in small farming look like. Stacy's story begins with Houston's Urban Harvest, where she discovered the power of community gardens and local food. From there, she and her family grew a herd of Nubian and La Mancha goats, started experimenting in the kitchen, and thanks to a little inspiration from her kids, launched a goat milk popsicle business that has been delighting customers and chefs for a decade. In this conversation, you'll hear about the business decisions behind building a farm enterprise, the role of mentorship and holistic management in shaping her path, the science of breeding and genetics that keeps her herd strong, and the ways she balances caring for animals, people, land, and community. We'll also touch on her 4Farmers grant, which is helping her bring new tools and technology into her breeding program. So, whether you're a foodie, a farmer, or just someone curious about where your food comes from, you're going to love this inside look at how one small farm is innovating, adapting, and thriving.
I started as an accountant when I was fresh out of school, CPA. And then like 7 years later, I had this little baby and I didn't want to do that work anymore. And so my husband was like, Stacy, just find something that makes you happy, that you want to do, that'll fulfill you. And so I just started following my heart, and Urban Harvest has these community gardens all over Houston.
Urban Harvest has been quietly changing the way Houstonians connect with food since 1989. Across the city, more than 50 community gardens and 100 school gardens are full of people learning how to grow vegetables, compost scraps, and share extra produce with neighbors. In neighborhoods where fresh fruits and vegetables are hard to come by, these gardens become small hubs of connection. Kids digging in soil at schools, families swapping tomatoes with neighbors, and surplus carrots making their way to local food banks. Urban Harvest also supports small urban farmers by providing training, resources, and a network to sell their produce locally, helping them make their gardens more productive and more sustainable.
And the next thing I knew, I was working in 5 of those. I had like one I'd go to every week with my baby in the car seat with the mosquito net over her, so the mosquitoes wouldn't eat her, right? Like crazy stuff. And Bob Randall, he's a community organizer in Houston. That's his baby. And I think the world of Mr. Randall. And so they do really good at taking urban like food deserts and making a little food island in them with these gardens, right? So then people growing and nurturing. I left those gardens in Houston and we bought 4 acres an hour from Houston. And that's what started my farm. Like we started with 4 acres of grass. And from there, now we have a lot. When I look back on that, was like 2004, 2005, we were making that step. Now, 20 years later, I have a dairy. I have 17 acres in the same county. Like we have all of this herd of dairy goats. And it all started with just vegetables I was growing for my family. And then a chef friend of mine, who used to also sell at that market, she picked up our vegetables. And then when other chefs heard I was working with her, we started a little CSA with 10 families. Then it grew to 20. Then we had 75. It's a long journey, right? So to get to the place where I had dairy goats I was 7 years into farming and my kids wanted dairy goats for Christmas. So Urban Harvest has been a huge part of me and what I do and why I do it.
I didn't realize that the Urban Harvest is part of your origin story. That's so cool.
And so when I had vegetables, I never sold at the vegetable market there because my farm with the 4 acres couldn't compete with the Atkinsons and the Gundermans that were there that have been generational farming, and they have, you know, 100 acres here and 45 acres there. Mm-hmm. So my little table was so small. I did much better with my CSA. But when we took a step into dairy and we started making our popsicles, I was kind of unique, kind of different. And I took a step into that market and I did it for 10 years. It's a long time. We started in 2015 and I pulled out in January of this year.
I remember talking to you about like that you had had a mentor said, do something and do it really, really well. And it sent you on this path in the popsicle direction. And so
yeah.
I think it would be really interesting to hear about, I mean, obviously you're an accountant, you have business acumen. I'd love to hear about the business side and your story in terms of the decision-making.
So pick up the story from there. We had 4 acres of vegetables, right? 75 people in a CSA, 5 restaurants in Houston, 200 chickens that we were moving on pasture, 12 pigs a year that we were selling half and whole shares. Because in Texas, you can't sell parts without a label. Labels are expensive. So we were selling half and whole hogs, but 12 a year is a lot. And then at some point, I turned around. The 2 goats we bought for Christmas were 10 goats in milk because they multiply really fast. And I was 7 years in and I took a class, a beginning farmer and rancher class with the Holistic Management Institute. So at 7 years, I was at the very end of being a beginner, but I got in. And they had a grant for that program. It was fantastic. So we, once a month, would travel to a different farmer ranch in Texas and we would spend the whole weekend there in these immersion classes. And it was really eye-opening for me because I did accounting, but I didn't do farm accounting. So one of the segments was farm-based accounting. One was land management. One was animal husbandry. So they touched on the whole farm. It's Alan Savory's model, okay, of the whole farm, right? So like, how does your farm interact with the community? How does your farm interact with your finances, with your family?
Alan Savory's holistic management model reframes farming as an interconnected system where the health of the land is inseparable from the well-being of the people who tend it. By rotating livestock in patterns that mimic wild herds, grasses are grazed and fertilized before being given time to recover, which restores soils, boosts biodiversity, and brings degraded land back to life. But the model goes further than land stewardship. It asks farmers to see their work in relation to their families, their finances, and their wider communities. A decision made in the pasture isn't just about grass. It affects livelihoods, relationships, and the resilience of the whole farm system. In this way, holistic management positions agriculture not only as a means of production, but as a way of weaving together ecological health, economic stability, and human connection.
So great program. And I got Peggy Maddox as my mentor. Peggy and her husband, the story goes that they lost $1 million ranching in West Texas and then were able to pull themselves out of bankruptcy and out of that $1 million hole. And they made it. Ranching. So they're really clever, smart, well-experienced person sitting at my table. And she looked at all the stuff I had going on and said, Stacey, you got to pick one. You got to pick one and you got to do it really well. And so I took a year off. From that moment, I had one employee and he had finished college and was like, we were both in a transition period. Like, Clay, you got to go find the next thing and I'm going to look at my next thing. And so he went to work for a friend of mine doing sustainable land management. And I took the year to kind of think about where I was going, what I was doing. And we had a lot of family meetings, like, what do y'all like? What do you want to do? And the kids kept coming back to, we like these goats. We like the babies. We like taking care of them. And so I was like, well, I can write a business plan and I can probably make a go of this. We had five farms in Houston. They were making Chev with the same breed of goats we had. And I knew all those people by their first name. So I didn't want to come into the market with a Chev or fresh cheese product. And so we were thinking buttermilk. We were thinking sour cream. And then we looked and our kids were eating a lot of ice cream. And so my husband bought me a little Cuisinart that sat on the countertop. And every day I'd make ice cream. And one day, Jessie, my daughter, was making oatmeal and she dumped a whole can of cinnamon in the oatmeal. And she said, oh, Mama, I'm so sorry. I said, oh, don't worry. I'm going to make ice cream. And so I put that oatmeal in my little Cuisinart with some milk. And my husband came home and I gave it to him. He was eating ice cream every day after work. And he said, Stacy, this is really good. You can make a go of this. So I went to Houston to that chef who first bought vegetables from me. And I sat with her at the table and said, Monica, do you think people would buy goat milk ice cream? And she was tasting it. And she's like, Stacy, put it on a stick. So she was the person who gave me the idea about the popsicle. So, yeah, from there, we just took off. It just took off like an idea that led to a business plan, that led to a local bank, agreeing that I could do it. And that's I have a whole nother story around that that was pretty crazy because it's not very easy for a woman farmer making a goat milk popsicle to eat alone. But we managed to get through it, right? And then we had to import a bunch of equipment from overseas. That's another, I have story after story I can tell you. It was not easy. But then, yeah, well, now we're here 10 years later, it's 10 years this year we've been doing that work, and I really love it. Really love the work we do.
I can tell you love it. Tell us a little bit about like the volume of your business. You're in restaurants. You said now you're doing wholesale. You're not in markets anymore, or you are sometimes. Yeah.
I pulled out of the farmer's market, and so we are serving mom and pop shops. Mostly anybody that'll have a freezer for me. I mean, we're in a chocolate shop in uptown Houston. We're in a park on the south side of town. I'm in two health food stores in Houston. We're at a bunch of other farms. Like during COVID, we realized that people were going out to rural areas. And so a lot of other farmers have farm stores and they picked up our product. And those are some of our best locations. I got one in Tomball, one in Waller, another in LaGrange. LaGrange is the furthest I drive to deliver pops. But it's another dairy farm. And they milk cows. They sell their milk to Bluebell to make ice cream. And then they put my goat milk pops right next to the Bluebell case. And I was like, yeah. I don't think we're going to sell any popsicles here, but we sell so many popsicles there. It's crazy. They have a great agritourism business. So
on a weekly basis, is that how your volume moves?
So I have an anchor customer in Houston and they're every week. And so every Tuesday, I know I'm delivering to Houston. And so I try to make contact with my Houston-based people. I'm going to be in Houston. Do you need product? And so we try to hit them on Tuesday. Then on Thursdays, I go out. So like to Tomball, to LaGrange, to Nassau Bay, anywhere that is longer than an hour's drive from me. We tried. I'm self-delivering those things on Thursday. So some weeks I'm off the farm. Most weeks I'm off the farm 2 days, Tuesdays and Thursdays. But the other days I'm on farm and like pasteurizing. Today, we are selling some genetics to Michigan. Really excited. It's the first time I've gone out of state with our genetics. So I had to get health papers. So
explain what you mean by that, about selling genetics to Michigan.
Yeah. So we're working really hard to improve our herd. And so the American Dairy Goat Association has it's a three-step stool. Like tools they give you to do that. And one is the Dairy Herd Improvement Program, which we participate in, not enough because I need more help. The linear appraisal where ADGA will send a judge to your farm and judge your goats against a standard and then give them a score that can tell buyers or equate to a mental picture of what the goat is. They don't even have to see a picture. Once you learn the scorecard and you say, oh, this goat is a 45 in top line and the angle of the rump, you know, her medial is this number and her arch on the udders, you can get a mental picture of what that goat looks like without even seeing her. So having a third party come and evaluate, then you can use those scores to sell your genetics or your the offspring of that animal. And then there's also showing, which is like not your goats against a standard, but your goats against whoever else showed up that day in the ring, which is sometimes tough, but it's also a good way to learn because you go and you meet other producers and you can see the size of your animals compared to theirs, like the body capacity. Is your nutrition program good? Is your 6-month-old doe the same size as the person next to you? Like maybe you have this problem you didn't realize you had, right? So showing gets you off farm and allows you to look at things from a different lens. So we participate in all three of those things with the idea that a goat who is well conformed will have a longer life and hopefully be more productive during that time. Because to spend the money it takes to get a goat from birth to milk, and her rump was too narrow when she kitted, is really heartbreaking, right? So we want to like have those conditions that set into motion success and then also productivity. And so the Dairy Herd Improvement Program helps with those scores. Like that information that comes back from that program is how much a doe make in her lactation. How much is she milking every month? So you can look month to month and then the year in total. Like all the components of the milk, the casein, the protein, the butterfat, which butterfat is the thing I care about. But a cheesemaker is going to look at the other two. Somatic cell count helps me with the state of Texas because we're inspected every month. And that's one of the things they're looking for. So it helps me to know where I am. So all of those things are what we're gauging to be better and better. So moving your genetics from Texas to Michigan helps us to put a foothold there. And then people see how lovely your does are. And then maybe more people from that part of the country reach out to you and call you and looking for what you have. We were 4th at the national show in one class this year. I'm really proud of that. Our goal was just to be in the top 20 in one class. And we got 4th in with a little junior doe, and then I was 19th with another.
Congratulations. That's a big accomplishment. I think when people think about a goat milk popsicle or just a popsicle in general, they're not really thinking about all of these, you know, really intricate sort of scientific details about the conformation of a goat or even the breed of a goat or what have you. So in order to make more popsicles, you need more milk and healthy goats, right?
Yeah, that's the key, right? And good producing goats, because a goat that makes a gallon a day and a goat that makes 2 gallons a day, they eat the same amount, right? So like the economics of that are real. So we're constantly trying to narrow the gap. Like to not to go too big with our herd size, but to narrow down our herd, like to get to a point where the most productive, most economical are the ones that stay. And it's really hard because they tug at my heartstrings.
Now, how many goats do you have? And talk a little bit to us about the breeds.
Yeah, so we had 70 before last week. We had 35 babies born on our farm this spring. I've sold quite a few. I haven't done the counts. I sold 8 goats in the last week. We're probably closer to 60, in the low 60s right now. I should go count heads.
Tell them to stand still.
I've got a lot of pens. And we have Nubians. So Nubians are the goats with the long ears. They have Roman noses. They're big goats. A good female can weigh 200 to 250 pounds. And the males, 300 to 400 pounds. They're big, big animals. And we have La Manchas. And they are equal in size, maybe not quite as big as the Nubians go, but so a good Nubian will make a gallon a day, but her milk is going to be really high in butterfat, rich and creamy and delicious. A good La Mancha will make 2 gallons a day and have a long lactation. They can milk for 2 years or sometimes 3 years without having a kid again. So every time you can extend a lactation like that and not have babies just means it's safer for your dough. We have to be mindful because I sell ice cream and we don't add cream. It's goat milk, cane sugar flavor, right? So can't be too La Mancha heavy because we really need the cream that the Nubians give us. So I would say a fourth of our herd is La Mancha. The rest is Nubian. Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about the volume of popsicles. Are you selling popsicles all year round? And what's your volume like?
We're selling popsicles all year long, but we're only making popsicles when we're in milk. So we start milking January and we'll go, depending on our market and how we sell, we'll milk until October, November, depending on the capacity, freezer capacity I have. Because there's like everything, right? There's like only so much capacity. We have a walk-in freezer when it's full and we can't shove anything else in there. We have to stop. So on a good day, we make between 500 and 700 popsicles. It's a lot of popsicles. That's like so we call them drops. So I think we're like 180 popsicles per drop. So my ladies that do that work in my kitchen, they work from 7:37 to 7:30 in the morning until 2. They have kids in school, right? So after school bus leaves, they come and then they got to get home before school bus shows up. So that's our work day. So we have some capacity, you know, if we wanted to grow, if we find more market for our product, we could work another shift really easily. And the more we work, the more efficient our equipment gets. We're thinking about adding some new products next year. Cajeta, the farm that we're buying our cajeta from to make our cajeta pop is retiring. So I'm thinking about picking up their cajeta business.
What is that?
It's a goat milk caramel. It's a fantastic old world caramel. So like 4 hours of milk and sugar and stirring. And it makes the most amazing, delicious caramel you can ever imagine.
Okay. So now the business focused on popsicles might be mature enough that it could expand.
Oh, yeah. I think we're ready. And the people that make that have been making the cajeta for our pops are the people we got our first 2 goats from. So when they told me, oh, we're thinking of retiring, I'm like, you got to teach me how to make it. I'm like, we're going to give you our equipment. So I went last week and learned. I had a cajeta lesson. And so we're hopefully going to bring that equipment on our farm pretty soon. And then that'll be the first thing. And then maybe yogurt next season. I'm talking to my inspector about helping me with that. So
sounds like you have some very good relationships with the people that you've learned from. And even as you mentioned just now, your inspector. Tell us a little bit about the relationships you have, how important they are.
Yeah, no, relationships are a big, big deal to me. I couldn't do the work that I do without the people that help me, mentor me. So the American Dairy Goat Association in particular, I mean, the resources that they have available. And just in our local goat community also, like when things happen and bad things always do, right? It's like a point of information and the people in Texas really share. We're looking at screwworm, the new world screwworm, by the way, that's in Mexico now coming and everyone's like keyed into that. Talked to my vet about that this morning.
The new world screwworm is fast becoming a crisis in Mexico, with 5,086 animal cases reported as of mid-August 2025, a staggering 53% increase since July. And 649 of those are still active. Cattle are the most vulnerable, but the parasite has also been found in sheep, horses, and even working dogs, making it a broad threat to farm operations. An outbreak in Texas could carry an estimated cost of $1.8 billion in livestock losses, a hit that would ripple through ranchers, feed suppliers, and local economies dependent on cattle production. The U.S. and Mexican authorities are scaling up efforts to ensure this does not happen. However, for farmers and ranchers, this means that vigilance is essential. Checking animals frequently, treating wounds quickly, and reporting any suspicious infestations, because the difference between a manageable problem and devastating herd loss often comes down to early detection and swift response.
But just having those people, I have a friend in Alice, she's going to be the closest one, right, to when they come across the border, probably. So like being in contact with those people and having a relationship that you can pick up the phone and say, hey, guess what happened? They found them here. You know, it's like good to have. I don't know how people operate without relationships like that. My inspector is key. I mean, because they're in my shop every month. They go to other places. So like if something's off or something's not the way it should be, they see every other dairy and how they operate can help me to fix it. But in order to get that information, you have to be present for them when they are there. It doesn't matter what I have going on. If she's there, I drop it and I go to be with her because I want to have that relationship. It's important.
I thought maybe I could ask you a little bit about the Four Farmers grant that you received a little while ago, just so we could, hear how it's going and just tell us a little bit about just the process in general and about what you were awarded and how that worked.
Yeah, Four Farmers allowed me to purchase an ultrasound machine that is helping me with my breeding program. So we talked about genetics and how we're trying to improve, right? And that ultrasound is part of the game that I'm playing to get better. So to understand if a doe is going to have babies after breeding, we know within 30 to 40 days with the ultrasound machine, also with a blood test. But I'm hopeful that I can get good enough with the machine that I can not have to do that blood test in the fall. Also, how many babies there are, because a doe that has one baby, you might feed different than a doe that has three or four babies, right? So those kids will demand a lot more nutrition if she has a heavy load. We worry about ketosis a lot with goats in the end of their pregnancies. And a doe that has heavy bread, it's going to be more at risk. But if you don't know, don't have that capacity to know, because you can't really tell by looking at them. Some does you can, but many are deep bodied. They hide very well, their babies, right? So that machine is going to be a key to being successful with those breedings and kittings and having safer kittings, because to know I have four babies coming, right? And that leads into the market. Like I know if this doe has four, my chances of having a doe out of her are maybe think about selling a buck and getting those lined up even maybe before she kids. So there's a lot of potential. I'm still working. I'm so green with it. I took it out. It's placed on the top shelf. We have had two breedings so far. I'm so anxious to get that machine out and get it working.
I wanted to give Shahid and Liana an opportunity to ask you some questions as well.
Sure.
So let's hear what you got.
So with the popsicles, I saw that on your website you have like several different flavors. And I was just wondering, how do you choose the flavors? Because some of them do look a little bit unique. So I just wanted to know how you choose.
So I am a creative person and I like to tinker in my kitchen. Right. So we make an avocado popsicle that I love. And that was like a brain. Like I have an avocado for lunch with a glass of milk. Right. And I was like, this kind of tastes good together. Wonder what this would be like in a popsicle. And it's really good. Like so different and so delicious. Some of our flavors were customer requests. Banana pudding, for example. I have a friend. He has a butcher shop and a barbecue shop in Crawford, Texas. And he asked for banana pudding. And so we're like, sure, we'll make it for you. And then we tasted it. And I was like, this is really good. Our newest flavor this year is passion fruit. And it was a request from Araya Chocolate in Houston because they sell a lot of their chocolate with passion fruit in it. So they think it would be a good seller in their shop. So a lot of customer requests, my best seller is chocolate because it's safe, you know, chocolate and then strawberry and then cookies and cream. We sell so much cookies and cream. That's what we're making tomorrow. Today we're making pumpkin spice and cajeta, the caramel. We have our customer in Tomball, their customers love pumpkin spice. So mainly we're making that for them for the fall. We make peppermint dark chocolate for Christmas. So we try to pull in some seasonal things. And we know that components in our milk change as lactation changes. So in the spring, the milk is light and fresh. And as the season progresses, that dough is feeding an older kid in theory, right? So it gets heavier, higher in fat. So as we enter the fall, our flavors change. And one of my favorite things to make in the fall is chai tea because it's so creamy and just really good. We have over 40 flavors.
Really?
Yes. And we have, that's crazy, right? And we have a yellow label that we put. So whenever we try a new flavor, we can change the ingredients on it. So it's like we can manipulate the flavors that way. Yeah, some of the most interesting are rose water. So Megan, who is my primary pop maker, is an Iraqi war veteran. And she had this rose popsicle when she was in Iraq. And she's like, Stacy, can we try? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Let's make it. So it is really good. That popsicle is delicious. Vanilla with cinnamon was a request from a customer at the farmer's market. It tastes like horchata, like a Mexican drink that they make in South Texas that we love so much. So it's a mixture of Stacy's crazy ideas and customers asking and what we have in front of us. So when I was at the market, we were buying whatever was left over from vegetable producers, if I could turn it into a popsicle. So we've made sweet corn pop. We've made Roselle popsicles. We've made blueberry. Our peach popsicle was all local peaches. So just trying to incorporate what Texas, the beauty that Texas gives us into our popsicles that are then so much better for that. We make a dewberry pop also that the dewberries are what people in Texas call wild blackberries. So these dewberries grow in our goat pastures like crazy, and we make those into a popsicle too. It's one of my favorites.
Hey, Shaheed, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I had one question. I was wondering, have you ever explored expanding into other like goat milk products other than, you know, the goat popsicles?
Yeah, so I tried making soap, and I make really awful soap. That was what I was trying before we had our dairy. I think our next expansion is going to be in cajeta, that caramel, because we need it for our cajeta popsicle. And it is shelf stable. So it's in a jar. It's a caramel. So that will be what we roll forward with this fall. And then hopefully by next spring, I will be making yogurt. Because I think that our existing customers, those health food stores, those farm stands across Texas that I'm already delivering popsicles too would love to have goat milk yogurt.
What are your popsicles called in the marketplace?
Well, the name of our farm is All We Need. It's kind of a joke. No, because when we bought our first 4 acres, I told my husband, baby, this is all we need. And then you're like, oh no, we need a shovel, we need some fertilizer, we need seeds. All we need is a tractor, some goats, some pigs, some chickens. Like, it never ends.
I'm always saying when people don't know what to talk to a farmer about is to ask about their farm name because there's always some backstory.
And our little town is Needville. So come on.
If you don't have a sense of humor, it's not worth going forward. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about your farm before we let you get back to popsicle making?
There's so many things I want to tell you about our farm. We love our animals. Like really. They're part, my kids say, Mom, you treat the goats better than us.
No chores for the goats.
It's a labor of love that I care a lot about my animals, but also about the people that work with me. Like that's one of, when we talk about the priorities we have on our farm, are the people that work with us, our customers, like taking care of them and our animals really well, maintaining our land so it gives back to our community. Those are like what we want to focus on. And expanding and growing, and that's all good, but not at the expense of those other things. So that's my first priority. So care of my herd and my employees and our customer base. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that all takes time to take care of well.
Well, lucky us. That was Stacy Roussel of All We Need Farm in Texas, reminding us that behind every pint of milk, every popsicle, and every caramel drizzle is a farmer making countless decisions about animals, land, community, and family. We heard how Stacy's path began in Houston's urban harvest gardens, how she scaled her business by focusing on one thing and doing it really well, and how a simple family moment led to the idea that would become All We Need Pops. We also got a glimpse into the less glamorous but essential side of farming, from herd improvement programs to ultrasounds and genetics, all of which ultimately make it possible for her to create the products we enjoy. Her story is a powerful example of why small and mid-sized farmers matter, and how innovation at a local scale ripples out to strengthen our communities, our economy, and our food system. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave us 5 stars and a written review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps more people find the show. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. As always, One Bite is Everything is co-produced by Sonia Dillon, with sound design and original music by Russell Chapa. Until next time, remember, every bite is connected to something bigger. I am your host, Dana DePrima, and I will see you right here next week.